became big business. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fundo Caduce, Armata Angela Kamen, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen. We're headed to Haiti for the 6-month anniversary of the earthquake. If you have ideas for stories, write to stories at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
It is no surprise that one of CFRU's longest-running and most popular programs is Clan na Gael. We feature 2 hours of the best Celtic music from around the world and around the corner. Listen on Sundays after the BBC World News at noon. Tune in and get your fill of fiddles, whistles, banjos, mandolins, barons, harps, flutes, and wonderful voices. And of course, let's not forget everyone's favorite Celtic musical instrument, the bagpipes. Clan na Gael is the most bagpipe-friendly show on CFRU FM 93.3. Join me, John Fahey, on Sundays and start your own Celtic Kitchen Ceilidh.
Come one, come all, and check out on the Shelf, your friendly neighborhood queer library and resource center. Out on the Shelf can provide you with over 2,000 book titles of special interest to your needs or your curiosities. We also have a countless variety of magazines, movie titles, pamphlets, and many other queer and trans resources available for you and the community. So come on in and visit us at Out on the Shelf, located at 141 Woolwich Street at the base of the Matrix building on the corner of Aramasa, and meet some of our many volunteers who work hard to keep our space safe and confidential. Help yourself to a cup of tea, browse the shelves, or kick up your feet and crack open one of your favorite books. To find out our hours and learn more on Out on the Shelf, please check out outontheshelf.ca or give us a call at 519-515-0691.
And now, the BBC World Service on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
And the Taliban. Google says China has renewed its operating license in an apparent compromise following a bitter row. Google had angered the Chinese leadership earlier this year by threatening to pull out over hacking and censorship. With more, here's Chris Hogg.
It appears the Chinese authorities have stopped short of punishing the American firm for its high-profile rejection of the rules regarding censorship here. In January, Google warned it might leave China. In March, it began to redirect visitors to its Chinese website to a site in Hong Kong automatically. Web searches on that site were uncensored. Last week, Google stopped automatically rerouting users, though. Instead, a click on google.cn led users to a page which they could then access the Hong Kong site from. This was judged to be a softening of its stance, a compromise aimed at ensuring its license would be renewed.
The United Nations Security Council has unanimously condemned the attack that caused a South Korean warship, the Chunnan, to sink earlier this year. But the statement, drafted by the United States, stops short of naming North Korea, despite an international inquiry which found the communist country was to blame. World news from the BBC. Coffins containing the recently identified remains of 775 victims of the Srebrenica massacre have passed through the Bosnian capital Sarajevo, watched by several thousand people. The remains, found in mass graves, will be buried at Potocari, near Srebrenica, on Sunday, marking the 15th anniversary of the killings. More than 7,000 Muslim men and boys died at the hands of Bosnian Serb forces in Srebrenica during the conflict. A Sri Lankan cabinet minister, who's leading a controversial protest against the United Nations, has offered to resign, saying he doesn't want to embarrass his government. The minister, Vimal Veerawansa, and hundreds of other people have been demonstrating at the UN compound in the capital, Colombo, against a UN panel investigating alleged war crimes in Sri Lanka. Charles Haviland reports.
On Friday, the ultra-nationalist minister continued to lie on a bed outside the UN office, only stirring occasionally to say he was continuing to fast. Ministers visited him to express solidarity. His associates said he'd offered to resign as housing minister, but that President Rajapaksa had rejected the resignation. However, senior presidential officials said they knew nothing of an offer to quit. Ban Ki-moon has reacted sharply to the demonstration by hundreds of flag-waving nationalists, saying the UN's work is being disrupted. In response, he has closed down a small regional UN office based nearby and recalled the local UN chief to headquarters.
The American pop singer Jennifer Lopez has called off a concert in northern Cyprus after protests from Greek Cypriots. The show was to have taken place at a luxury resort in the Turkish Cypriot part of the island. But thousands of Greek Cypriots joined in a protest on the social networking site Facebook, saying her appearance later this month would have legitimised the division of the island and the confiscation of their property. BBC World Service News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and this is Europe Today, with all today's European news and international developments affecting the continent. Well, the swap is done. Today, on the tarmac of an airport in Vienna, the 10 people who admitted to spying for Russia in the United States were exchanged for 4 people freed from jail in Russia. One plane flew east, the other flew west, and the biggest such deal since the end of the Cold War was over. Well, we're hoping to go live to our correspondent in Vienna in just a moment for the latest, but just a reminder, the 10 people heading east have now apparently arrived back in Moscow, and the lawyer representing one of them, Anna Chapman, has been defending what she did.
The issue is, if you're in a foreign country and your government asks you to do something that does not involve in your mind information that would jeopardize the security of that country, would you provide such information? Obviously, in retrospect, if she had to do it over again, she would not have provided such information.
Well, Anna, of course, is the red-headed lady, very much the pin-up, many are saying, of this whole crisis. And indeed, her mother, Irina Kushchenko, has also been talking about her daughter.
I fully support my daughter. I know she is right. I have confidence in her, and I am sure they haven't done anything terrible. No matter what's happened and what was said about her, we will always be there for her.
Well, Svetlana Kuznitsia is a journalist working in Moscow. I asked her what Russians were making of all this.
Everybody is enjoying because it's like a gift for summer absence of news and so on. So some people, of course, are laughing about the whole situation, and especially considering the old school KGB methods of using the information, transforming the information, digging money, undigging money, and so on. The others, which is a minority, I have to say, just seeing it as a very special and serious operation of the Americans, because these spies are supposed to be very serious.
Do they think they really are spies on each side?
No, the majority thinks it's just, I don't know, some people who are quite useless and getting a lot of money for doing basically nothing and so on. And another part and another camp thinks that they were quite professional and seriously trained spies. And these are KGB officers and ex-spies are talking.
Does it make people feel more anti-Western, anti-US?
Not at all, no. I think just probably the opposite. The speed the operation was done and the efficiency is very unusual, because before it was long negotiations, quite dramatic from both sides and so on. And this time it was absolutely easy. But the only thing is the score, like 4-10. So it's not in Russia's favour.
What about Anna Chapman? Because, as you probably know, in a lot of the coverage in America and Britain, she's become the kind of pin-up, really, of the whole thing. Is it the same there?
She is the most fascinating figure, and several ex-spies are already going to write books about her and so on. And she's really, her mom is now saying that my daughter is completely innocent and she is just an ordinary woman I shall say, with an extraordinary looks and so on. Her pictures are also in the most of the new Russian newspapers and magazines and even on Central Russian channels. Whatever happens, I'm sure that they will get a medal, which is quite a well-forgotten medal, for assistance to Russian intelligence service. There is such a medal, which was a surprise discovered in the last several days.
Svetlana Kurnitsia, a journalist working in Moscow. Well, let's now go to Vienna, where our correspondent Bethany Bell, we can now join her. Bethany, it all happened in Vienna. Was anything visible?
Yes, we could see the two planes sitting side by side on the runway. We saw the...
I think by the sound of it, we may have lost Bethany there. We'll try and get back to Bethany a little bit later in the programme if we can. But just a confirmation that that spy swap has now gone through. And with latest we're hearing is, in fact, that the plane taking the some of the people who were released from Russia is now on its way to Washington. Now, after all the weeks of drama, the goals, the misses, the joy, the anger, the hope, the disappointment, would it be Africa's breakthrough? Would it be South America's comeback? Well, on Sunday, it's all going to be over, and the two teams in the Soccer World Cup will walk out onto the pitch at the Soccer City Stadium in Johannesburg for the final, and they're going to be both European, Spain and the Netherlands, in fact. But there were high hopes, of course, of an African triumph for the first finals to be held in Africa. Ghana certainly did well, but Nigeria's Super Eagles team were knocked out very early. The country's president even tried to ban them from international games for a while in order to try and rebuild the team. Well, now a BBC investigation has learned that the International Football Association, FIFA, was warned before this year's World Cup of fears that Nigeria's team could be vulnerable to match-fixing. A UEFA investigator in South Africa raised concerns, including over betting patterns. Nigeria went out of the tournament, of course, in the first round, losing to Greece. FIFA says they have no indication of match-fixing in any World Cup matches, but they don't deny getting a warning. Richard Watson of BBC Newsnight programme has more details, joins me now. Richard, are you able to say any more about who sent these warnings?
Well, we've agreed to protect his identity, our source, but I can say that he's an investigator who has penetrated criminal match-fixing rings and has inside knowledge of how they work. And, of course, he's got excellent contacts. He's now working closely with the European football regulator UEFA on match-fixing investigations across Europe. And one case underway now involves more than 200 games across the continent, which are suspected of having been rigged. Now, we understand he and others in UEFA's investigations team became suspicious about Nigeria during the qualifying round the World Cup, and we're told that sources within the Nigerian squad had tipped off UEFA's Disciplinary Services Unit, which examines evidence of match fixing. Now, our source also spoke with a German journalist, Christian Bergmann.
An informant called me, and he was down in South Africa, and he talked to me and said, here's some information that players of the Nigerian team are actually involved in some form of manipulation.
You know? So your source was convinced that it was fixing going
on? Yeah, my source was 100% convinced that this was happening.
Christian Bergmann there. Richard, do you think that Nigeria's matches were actually fixed?
Well, we simply just don't know that. We can't be sure. All we can say with certainty is that warnings were sent to a special unit run by FIFA, the body responsible for the World Cup. This is known as FIFA's early warning system. In a statement to the BBC, FIFA did not deny receiving these warnings and said they have a network of informants, but they said there is no indication whatsoever of any match-fixing situations during any of the matches of the 2010 FIFA World Cup.
Why do people want to fix matches? I mean, where's the money made?
Well, it's all about betting. I mean, basically, if players are bribed to throw matches, then criminal networks can bet on a near certain result and reap millions of pounds in or dollars in profit. The most notorious match fixer recently was a chap called Ante Šapina, a Croatian national, who was convicted of match fixing in 2006. He's now under arrest once again for running a huge network, a criminal network, which made millions from betting on these kind of fixed games.
Richard, is there a British connection in this?
Yeah, there is. BBC Newsnight has obtained German police documents which reveal that much of the betting money in the European investigations into Ante Šapina's network actually flowed through London. A betting company called Sanvo handled the bets, and Sanvo is a major player in the industry and makes millions from placing bets from high rollers and betting syndicates around the world. But we know that German and British police both raided their headquarters in London last November and seized records and documents.
Interesting stuff. Richard, thanks very much. much indeed, Richard Watson, there, BBC's Newsnight with that investigation. And you're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Europe Today. Now, coming up later in the programme, it's 2 months after European leaders signed up to a multi-billion euro fund to prop up governments in debt. It was quite a big deal at the time.
$1 trillion.
Massive package.
The future of the euro.
Turmoil.
The future of the euro.
Massive package.
So 2 months on, we'll be looking in some detail as to whether all that is actually working. A cultural evening in Germany designed to illustrate the sights and sounds of a different culture. This was part of a report from a German television programme from last year, with Africans in traditional dress singing and playing the drums as German children looked on. All done in the zoo at Eberswalde, just outside Berlin. And very popular these events have been. Tomorrow night, it's the 6th African Zoo Night, intended to support and highlight the San people of Namibia. All very worthwhile and laudable, you might think, but not everyone's happy. A group of Africans living in Germany say staging this at a zoo gives out an unwelcome and offensive message. Edode Ojake is a Nigerian actor living in Berlin, and I asked him why this was making people so angry.
I think every African is outraged at this. The zoo is a place where animals are kept. The zoo is not a cultural studio. The zoo is not a place where you present people's culture. And if you look at the history of black and white, especially here in Europe, I mean, I just find it very, very insensitive.
So your objection is not to the exhibition itself, but to where it's being held, is that right?
Yes, my objection is to where it is being held. I really can't understand why people can be so insensitive. You do not exhibit people's culture in a zoo. I mean, we are not animals. It is not a place that you show people. We go to the zoo to look at strange animals that are not so strange, but the place where you go to learn about animals, not about people's culture. You see, African culture is not taught in European schools, not even the history of African and European interaction. If you want to teach the European about African culture, then look for the proper forum for it. Look for the proper place.
All right, but supposing I said to you that the idea is to try and get as many people to come along and see this as possible. Now, if you have it in a zoo where there are lions and giraffes and elephants, animals that perhaps would be in the same environment as the San people, which is what we're talking about here, that's a way of perhaps illustrating in a way that's going to make people come and watch it. Not to say that the people themselves should belong in a zoo, but just saying this is the context.
I'm sure you find that also funny. We know the history of Germany and the San people. I cannot for one moment believe that the people who are organizing this event find it the most appropriate place to show San culture. It's got nothing to do with the lions and the giraffes. These are human beings. They are not giraffes.
Just explain about the relationship. You were talking about the history of Germany and the San people. Give us a picture of that.
Well, I mean, it is public knowledge that Germany was in Namibia. The atrocities Germany committed, Germans committed in Namibia, is almost a taboo subject. We don't talk about it. A lot of people don't hear about it. There's no apology. There is nothing. And you add this to the fact that Africans have been presented in zoos in Europe and in America. I mean, there's no other conclusion you can come to than that this is another way of reducing the image of the African people. I don't know whether this is the motive of the people who are organizing this exhibition. If it is not their motive, then I do them injustice. But I think it is very, very insensitive after all these interactions to bring up African people, African culture to the zoo to show people. You do not teach people's culture in a zoo. I mean, this is my point.
the views of Edore Ojake there. So I got Rudiger von Versen, who's a member of the association organising the event, to listen to that, and I asked him what he and the other organisers thought.
We have been very shocked because we didn't take into account that such a big reaction could happen. Because what we are doing, we try it to our by our activities to overcome all that remains of the apartheid in Southwest Africa, and also remains of colonialism. We bring the culture of the Zan people in the north of Namibia to the German people. We do that by going into schools, teaching the people there about Namibia in general and the Zan people in particular. We also get high support by the Namibian embassy, and I think everybody wouldn't believe that the Namibian embassy would support any activity of racism or exhibition of black people in the zoo.
Do you think the zoo was the right place to stage this?
I think the zoo is one of the places where events to raise money for the Zan people can be organized. The zoo is just like a park, and we are using this park for our event. We provide the people there with German dancing groups, with a German band, yes, also with friends from Congo who help very much in our activities, and also these people from the Congo, a band of drummers, never would say that they are exhibited in a zoo and wouldn't come.
It's about the San people in Namibia, so why are you using Congolese people? Why not use San people to show?
Because we... there are not so many Zan people here in Berlin we can ask to join us.
But isn't it like showing off French people to illustrate something in Spain? I mean, it doesn't make much sense, does it?
Here you would speak about European people.
Let me ask you about the opposition to this. Has there been a lot of complaint?
There have been some complaints by emails. The interesting thing is that the most of them were in the writing very harmonized, so we think it was a network or a group of people who expressed some concerns. But the problem is that nobody made any personal contact to get more information about our activities. There was just a statement. I mean, if anybody would ask us about what we are doing, what the foundation is doing, I strongly believe that some of them, at least some of them, would change their mind.
Rudiger von Versen, well, what do you think? Is it insensitive, as Edode said, to run an African culture night in a zoo? Or, as Rudiger says, is a zoo really just like a park? You can email your thoughts to us, worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com, or go on our Facebook page. We had one comment there. Stevie Nixon says, talk about political correctness gone mad. What next? Now, Sunday marks the 15th anniversary of the start of Europe's worst act of mass murder since the Second World War. In July 1995, the Bosnian War was still underway, in which ethnic Serbs, Muslims and Croats fought each other. The eastern Muslim enclave of Srebrenica was under the protection of Dutch peacekeepers, but the Bosnian Serb army overran the UN safe haven. The Muslim men and boys were separated from the women and led off to be killed. Thousands of others who tried to flee were shot. In all, over 7,000 died during the Srebrenica massacre in an act labelled genocide by the UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. Our Balkans correspondent Mark Lowen has been to Srebrenica to meet those trying to move on 15 years after the massacre.
I'm bumping around in a 3-ton doorless Hummer driving through the dramatic mountains around Srebrenica. This 5-metre-long beast of a car was built by the driver next to me, Rob Zomer, a former Dutch soldier stationed here with the UN at the height of the war in 1995. 15 years on, Rob has decided to move back and has picked me up in town to take me to the family home he's building up in the mountains. You said you were looking for peace and quiet, and you found it here.
You can see, it's really nice here. And only what you heard is the birds.
The location is beautiful indeed, but in July 1995, this area was where over 7,000 Muslim men and boys were massacred. Srebrenica had been declared a UN safe zone, but the Bosnian Serb army easily overran the lightly armed Dutch battalion, of which Rob was a part.
So why, 15 years on, has he returned?
I have history here. Bad or good, but I have history. It is a part of me. But that is not why I go to here. I go here for the forest, the mountains. Some people ask me that I feel guilty for 95. Absolutely not. I know for sure that I, but also I think everybody, do more as what we can do for the people here.
You did the most you could do.
Yeah, more as what we can do, we do.
But his country has been consumed by national guilt ever since the massacre. The Netherlands has struggled to accept what happened under the watch of its soldiers, blamed for their passive approach. An independent report in 2002 was heavily critical, prompting the resignation of the entire Dutch government. Rob says that coming back is the way to confront the past.
When I come in 95 from Srebrenica to Holland, I was not good in my head and I destroyed a lot of things. And we heard that we do a lot of really bad things here. After all the years that you heard it a lot of time, then you doubt yourself. And when I come here and the local people say to you, thank you that you was here in 95 and thank you that you tried to protect my family, a lot of bad feelings is gone.
Rob plans to build a guest house here to give the town the chance to develop in other ways.
I think when people see that Srebrenica is not only war, then this area can also grow. That's one of my goals.
That desire to form a new future for Srebrenica is also the aim a few kilometres away in the CMOS car parts factory. It was opened 5 years ago in the hope that employment might help the wounds to heal. 100 people work at the factory, 77 Muslims and the rest ethnic Serbs. It's a model of reconciliation between the two communities, though not yet replicated in the wider town. Almedina Yasharovic, a Muslim, is a 23-year-old worker who lost her father and brother in the massacre. But a full-time job has helped her to start afresh.
The work is great. We all get along. I have no problems with Serbs who work here. They are here to earn money, just like me.
But as we start talking about her father and brother, Almedina drops her guard. The tears come as she remembers the last time she saw them as they fled into the forest 15 years ago. Only some remains of her father have been found.
I can only remember them through photos. Nobody could forgive that. The Serbs here talk and laugh with you as if nothing happened. They know what they did. They are not ashamed of it, and they should be.
But that's rejected by many Serbs here, who feel unjustly demonized. Mladen Grujicic shows me the brochure of his association, which helps the families of Serb victims of the war. He says Srebrenica can't move on and overcome its deep segregation until what he calls the truth is established.
The Serb people are portrayed in the media as committing genocide, but it isn't so. No Serbs contest that a crime happened in Srebrenica, but they are insulted when the numbers are manipulated. I don't agree that 7,000 or 8,000 people were killed, because the Muslims themselves don't agree on the figures. Everyone talks about July 1995, but not the years before that. The first victim in Srebrenica was a Serb.
At the main cemetery, the digging goes on. The remains of another 700 victims found recently in mass graves will be buried on Sunday. Everybody here has their way of trying to lay the past to rest. But with so many reminders and such raw memories, it is hard to escape the dark clouds of 95 that still choke this little Bosnian town.
Mark Lowen there, reporting from Srebrenica, which Sunday will mark the 15th anniversary of that massacre. You're staying with Europe Today, I hope. Stay tuned for more coming up in the next half hour.
If you're new to the BBC World Service and are trying to work out what's on when, we've got a neat little way to help you. Go to bbcworldservice.com and click How and When to Listen.